at Alaire.com.
I'm Christopher Light, and this is The Connection. Part of the indoctrination of our guest David Kessler when he first came to run the Food and Drug Administration in 1990 was a lesson in irony. A few Sudafed packages that had been maliciously laced with cyanide in the Pacific Northwest, that was an emergency that prompted a nationwide recall, but cigarettes that were government certified to be dangerous, known to have killed many millions of smokers, weren't even on the FDA agenda. The story of David Kessler's term in Washington is of one determined bureaucrat's rolling the lethal tobacco ball up the hill of public attention against all the forces of government gravity and special interest interference that kept rolling it down. What David Kessler brought to light was the tobacco industry's clear knowledge that cigarettes are a drug delivery device, that they're making an addictive product that kills people. And still, the Supreme Court ruled that Congress never empowered the FDA to classify nicotine as a drug or to regulate it. Connection listeners, who's got a better idea of how to help young smokers especially realize what they're getting into? Do people you love still smoke? And how could you imagine reaching them? 1-800-423-8255 makes the tobacco connection with the scourge of the tobacco industry, David Kessler. His book is called A Question of Intent, A Great American Battle with a Deadly Industry. Our phone again, 1-800-423-TALK, or you can join us online at theconnection.org. David Kessler, welcome. This is such a fascinating sort of up-the-hill-and-down story. I wish you'd take us over the course, just starting in 1990, with what you thought the job was and what the tools were in hand to accomplish it. What were you up to then?
FDA is the most important consumer protection agency in the world. It regulates everything that comes in contact with the body. It regulates everything we ingest. It regulates the blood supply, vaccines, medical devices. And it regulates 25 cents on every consumer dollar. It was a young man at the agency when I got there. He was 29 years old, didn't have the typical resume because even at 29 years, he had already worked for both Dan Quayle and Ralph Nader. And he came up to me, and in fact, it wasn't just me. He raised a simple question with everybody he could talk to at the agency. Why does an FDA regulate tobacco? It regulates everything else that comes in contact with the body. And everywhere he went, he got the same answer. You can't do that. They're too big. They're too powerful. It's a fool's errand. They'll come after you. They'll cut your budget. And when he first raised it with me, I looked at him as if he were crazy. I mean, when I came to Washington, I wanted to work on getting AIDS drugs to patients who needed them out sooner. I wanted to cut the review time for serious and life-threatening, for drugs for serious and life-threatening diseases. I wanted to do, you know, that little box that appears now on all packaged food, that nutrition facts panel. I wanted to work on food labeling. And then we had the crises, as you said. Sudafed, people had died in the Pacific Northwest. I could go from a crisis to crisis to crisis. I wanted to be FDA commissioner. I even campaigned to be FDA commissioner. I got the job. And then after a while, I realized the question wasn't, you know, having the job. The question was, what was I going to do with the job? And we put together a small team. It wasn't the normal team that you would expect at the FDA. One actually was a former Secret Service CIA agent. One was a polygraph expert. One was an investigative journalist. And one had actually worked for the tobacco companies as a public relations expert. And we started asking a question that no one ever asked. I mean, is nicotine a drug under the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act? Now, to understand where we went, where we had to go, you have to understand the definition of a drug in the law. It's an article intended to affect the structure or function of the body. Does nicotine affect the structure or function of the body? Of course it does. Go into any library, type in the word nicotine, and you'll find thousands of articles on nicotine's effect on the central and peripheral nervous system. Does that make it a drug under the Act? No, because there's that other word, intended. And the courts have interpreted that word intended to mean the company's intent. So if you asked Philip Morris, what do you intend from nicotine? The answer you got, well, it's in there naturally. I mean, it's in there for taste. It's in there for flavor. Do you intend, Philip Morris, nicotine's effect on the structure or function of the body? Do you intend nicotine's pharmacological effects? No, of course not. So this group went where no one had ever gone before, inside the industry, to determine, to try to understand what the companies intended.
Obviously, there was a lot of double talk here. Inside, they had a different language. One of the comments from one of your sources, Deep Cough, as you called him, says in your book, we were never told to use the word. We were told never to use the word nicotine. We called it either impact or satisfaction. There was another language used inside for all the effects that they had pretty well certified and calibrated and studied and indeed manipulated, right?
Euphemisms. It was all scripted. I'm sitting there, actually, after I left the agency, trying to understand what I did not see when I was in the midst of this investigation. And I'm talking to as high-ranking a tobacco industry official, I mean, as there was. And his code name was Veritas, and he talked in code. And I, to be honest, I didn't understand him when he was first here. I had studied this issue, I mean, for years, and he was talking in codes. He was talking about mazes within mazes, the blind librarian, the big black notebooks. You had to study it like the catechism. They programmed it into you, and he kept on going bzzz, like a conditioned reflex, like the buzzer. And then he said everything was scripted. The script was etched in stone. And then the light went off in my head. The script, it was written by the industry lawyers in the 1950s and 1960s. Everyone in the industry had to follow the script, and follow it they did for 50 years. The script, cigarettes are not proven to cause cancer. Nicotine is not addictive. It was the longest running scheme ever to put the nation's risk at health. It was written by the lawyers.
People will always remember your tenure there for breaking the code, for getting the people out into the hearing tables, and of course for launching Jeffrey Wigand on the world in the movies and making it, the cracking of this sort of Rosetta Stone happened under your pressure and on your watch. The incredible thing is that the Supreme Court then turned around and said, but Congress never intended you to
but
do
before
this.
We get to the Supreme Court, let me tell you a little about, you mentioned Jeffrey Wigand. I am, it's 1994, and our investigators find an informant who wants to talk to us, but insists on only talking to me, will not talk to any other member of the team. Basically, so scared that in his mind, this informant said, look, if it's worthwhile my coming out, if I'm going to put myself at risk, I need to talk to the commissioner. I need to talk to the lead person. So I agreed to talk to him, and I know this informant only by the code name Research. And I am sitting there across the table in my office with Research, and I'm trying to get leads on other people who may talk to us, other names. And I have a lot of documents from the industry with lists of names of people. And I say, who's this person? Who's that person? Do you think so-and-so would talk to us? And then I said, who's Jeffrey Wigand? And he smiled, and he said, I'm Jeffrey Wigand. I didn't even know that I was talking to Wigand. But your question was about the Supreme Court. I sat there. We lost. We lost 5-4, the same 5-4 as in the recent electoral decision.
Five is Rehnquist, Scalia, Thomas, O'Connor, and Kennedy. Okay.
The first question out of Justice O'Connor Cigarettes are no different. Nicotine is no different than a horror movie.
This is a question?
This was a question. Within three minutes, a horror movie gets your adrenaline pumping. Scalia, Rehnquist, we haven't learned anything. There's nothing new since 1938. I am sitting there after, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, I mean, of this investigation, of determining, I mean, for the first time, I think, what being able to show of what the companies knew, what they did for the, with nicotine, what they intended, what they privately knew, despite what they publicly said, and it made no difference. But in some ways, I can't blame the Supreme Court. When they looked at this product, they saw a cigarette. And I think even for me, when I first looked at this, I mean, I said, a cigarette, I'm going to regulate this as a drug? You got to be kidding. I didn't understand it, even as a physician. I think they looked at this product like a lot of people look at this product. This is a consumer product. People smoke for satisfaction. They smoke for pleasure. They buy the company's lines. This is an issue of adult choice.
But don't cut them too much slack. I mean, in your book, you write about the tests that were made in the industry to determine what is the level that where addiction kicks in. And when an addict is trying to shake it,
there was a target dose. I mean, they knew the target dose.
You can bring the dose down to 15 cigarettes, but that seems to be maintenance of a certain kind of habit. And more than 5 cigarettes, some people can, you write in the book, can smoke 5 cigarettes and not get hooked. But somewhere in that zone between 5 and 15 cigarettes lies a
clear
threshold.
They knew exactly the daily dose of nicotine to sustain a smoker, to sustain an addiction. I didn't understand this until we started sending cigarettes to our own laboratory. Merit cigarettes. We measured the nicotine concentration. Merit regular cigarettes, 1.46% nicotine. Merit ultralight cigarette, 1.99% nicotine. The lightest cigarette had the highest concentration of nicotine. What was going on here? Why does the lightest cigarette, light cigarettes, when you think, say to someone, it's a light cigarette, you think less tar, less nicotine. What happened was, with those light cigarettes, I mean, it was the same thing that happened in the 1950s. I mean, after the first link between smoking and cancer, what happened was this: the industry put filters in front of cigarettes. Mm. Filters take out what? They take out tar. They take out nicotine. Why do people smoke? They smoke for nicotine. What did the industry have to do? It had to go to tobacco with higher concentrations of nicotine. Because if you don't maintain that nicotine level, then people, what's going to happen? People are not going to smoke.
But so as a doctor and as a scientist and as a student, a lawyer also who studied this case, do you have the slightest doubt in your own mind, talking to the Supreme Court again, if you did, that this is meets the standards of a drug?
No question.
Okay, we'll come back to that after the break. Our guest, David Kessler, ran the Food and Drug Administration, starting with Bush the Elder in 1990. He's the man who basically said, hey, there's an elephant in the middle of the room. It's called tobacco. It's killing people. It's addictive. They know it. Let's do something about it. We'll be back. 1-800-423-TALK. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Still ahead on The Connection today, Gladiator, traffic, and several others.
David Kessler, who ran the Food and Drug Administration through the 90s, starting with the first Bush administration, and who insisted, against a lot of frustration, finally by the Supreme Court, that tobacco and nicotine is not just addictive, not just lethal, but ought to be classified as a drug and regulated that way. 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection. There is a kind of larger metaphorical model here for taking on big questions in government in Washington and hoping to get away with it. It reminded me a little bit of a scene in that movie Traffic where Michael Douglas says the drug czar, they're flying across the country, he's got his whole top staff there, and he says, I want to get out of the box here. I want some big idea, something new. We're on our own. We can do anything here. And it goes completely silent. nobody's got a fresh idea, or if they do, they don't dare voice it. Did you confront that in Washington? Is that part of the problem?
It's why I wrote the book. I wanted to share what it's like taking on big challenges. Tobacco, in some ways, is just the metaphor. This was a job to me when I started out. I wanted the job. And then here I am in Washington, and I get this job. And it wasn't until the moment where I realized it wasn't about the job that was important. It's what do you do with the job? Once you want to keep your job in Washington, you can't do your job in
Write that down, kids. Once you want to keep your job in Washington, you can't do your job in Washington.
Yeah, I remember I was asked a question. There was a reporter who asked me the question, are you willing to be fired by the president if the president doesn't go along with you on tobacco? Now, how do you answer that question? If you say, yes, I'm willing to be fired, I mean, you sound arrogant. If you answer, no, I'm not willing to be fired, you sound like a wimp. And I just sat there, and all of a sudden I simply said to the reporter, and the cameras were rolling, I said, we rent. He didn't get it at first. And then his producer started laughing because I really think you have to be very careful. You can't threaten to resign, but you have to know what's resignable. When you take on these issues...
That's a wonderful answer.
The thing that I probably more than anything became convinced of, if you want to make inroads, if you look at who really... This isn't about winning or losing. You were never going to win the tobacco issue in its entirety. We'll make progress. But the real difference, the people I respect most in that town, the people I respect most when it comes to taking on policy questions, are those who are willing to dedicate their careers, who are willing to be persistent. Those who come and go, who take on an issue for a year or two, they're not going to... It's sticking with it. I remember I was sitting around the
table...
But
those are the renters. And those are the renters who,
But being a renter doesn't mean you're not willing to stay. It just means that there's a point where you're willing. It's not worth it to do that. I remember I'm sitting around the table with a bunch of FDA employees. I mean, and I was going around saying, "What do you think we should do?" I mean, and there were those who said, "Look, it's tobacco is awful. I mean, we really think you should do something, but you can't because it'll tie up the agency forever. They'll cut our budget. It's a fool's errand. You just can't put the agency at risk." And I went around the table, and there was a young woman, a lawyer. Her name was Catherine Lorraine, and she looked at me and said, "If you're willing to take on tobacco, I'm willing to spend the rest of my career working on it. If you're going to take on these issues, you have to be able to persist in these, because what they throw at you, when they come after you, I mean, the industry got the Congress to investigate us. They did get the Congress to actually cut our budget. They had former FDA commissioners on retainer. This is an industry that had a plan. It was called Operation Rainmaker. I didn't realize this until I was researching the book. Operation Rainmaker. The tobacco industry wanted to buy media outlets, so that they wanted to buy UPI. They had a whole plan so that they could control the press. There was even a point where they had a plan to support certain Islamic fundamentalist sects that interpreted the Quran to permit smoking. This is an industry that thought it could buy anyone it wanted.
Talk about some of the people who stood up in Washington. Talk about some of the people who didn't. When you first met Hillary Clinton, she said, it's a no-brainer that it's addictive. I mean, it would be Orwellian to think not. And Bill Clinton, as I read your description, kind of thought of somebody else to talk to and turned away.
Well, it was a Christmas reception, and my wife and I were invited. And it was actually the first time that I had met President Clinton. And we were off in a corner, and he came up. You know, he wandered through the crowd, and we were just off in a corner with him. And he was absolutely convinced that he had lost control of the Congress.
This is 1994 Newt Gingrich contract Congress, yeah.
Right. He was absolutely convinced that he lost for two reasons, guns and tobacco. And he said, in essence, you can't take on those issues. And my wife just looked at him and said, why are you president then if it's not to take on issues that matter? The second time, the next time I met him.
And he said?
The next time I met him, it was very interesting. We had given him the results of our investigation, hundreds of pages. And he read every single page. And I was called up to the private residence. And I walked into the study. And he looked at me. And he said, I want to kill them. Very different change. Look, how do you get a president when you're an agency head? How do you get a president to back you? And you know what? He wasn't with us initially. When he got there, he was stronger than anyone else. But what we basically had to do is think: who are the four or five people who have the president's ear? I mean, who we have to be able to convince so that they would convince the president.
Who was on your five? I mean, was Dick Morris there? Was Hillary there?
They were both there, and the one who was absolutely terrific. And I know people are somewhat cynical when he gave the speech about his sister in 1996. But Al Gore really wanted to do this. He, I'm convinced, is the one who convinced the president to take this on. You know, when you get a president out there on an issue, you have to be very careful. I mean, you get a president out there on something like health care. I mean, and a president gets killed. What does that mean for the issue? For the next person, the president who wants to come and take on something like health care? We got the president. I mean, the president agreed. But what was very important was to show that you can take on an issue like this and not get your head handed to you. When Clinton took this on, he won Kentucky in 1996. It showed that you can take on an issue and still survive.
Sounds more and more like the movie Traffic. I mean, it's a different problem and a different cast of characters, but in terms of the game...
It's not a game. You got to get to... I mean, this is until, you know, we quickly... You know, maybe this was an issue. I mean, maybe this was just a policy issue. But we quickly got to the point where we believed so strongly in what we did. I mean, they brought harassment charges, I mean, against one of our investigators. They got the Congress, the industry got the Congress to hold hearings to investigate us. Mm-hmm. They threw everything they could at us. This was not a game. I mean, we got to the point, I mean, I would stay up till 3, 4 o'clock in the morning and just read every single tobacco document, I mean, that I could get our hands on. I mean, we had this puzzle, and we just had to put the pieces together.
Our guest, David Kessler, ran the Food and Drug Administration from Bush the Elder through most of the Clinton years. He's now the dean of the medical school at Yale. Give him a call at 1-800-423-8255. The tobacco war is not over, and it's not all about federal regulation either. There are the class action damage suits at the state and federal levels. The question really is, what's going to keep the kid next door, your own kids, people you dearly love, out of the lure of lethal tobacco? 1-800-423-TALK is our phone. Rad is calling from Buffalo, New York.
Good morning, Chris. Good morning, Dr. Kessler. Thanks, Dr. Kessler, for all the good work that you and your staff have done with respect to this issue. I was going to ask you a little bit about Congress and their complicity in this, but you've talked a little bit about that already. I'd like you to talk about two different topics that I think are interesting. I've always been fascinated by the information that was pried out through discovery process of the various lawsuits. And one of the things that I often thought about was why over the 30 or 40 years that this fraud was being perpetrated on the country, that more of these documents weren't leaked out. They always weren't in the possession of attorneys who had confidentiality requirements with respect to their clients. You know, there were secretaries and people filing these things and so on. And the other question I'd like to, and I'll take these off the air, the other thing I'd like to talk to ask you about is a little bit about the tobacco strains that were grown in other countries outside the United States and the overseas laboratories, if you could talk about that and the experiments that they were doing.
Great questions. You know, it's interesting. I try to go back over the last 3 years after I left the agency to try to understand what happened for the last 50 years. How did we get where we are? And I think there's a fascinating story, and I tell it. I mean, and I only realized it toward the end of writing it, at the end of the book. I think it's not about tobacco. I mean, it goes interestingly. It goes to the heart of our legal system. If you look at the tobacco CEOs, they came and went. In fact, the seven CEOs that testify, none of them still are CEOs of those companies. But the lawyers stayed, the same law firms stayed for 50 years. They wrote a script. And the essence of the basis of our legal system is that the client, you can do anything in defense of the client as long as you don't commit a crime. Any amount of evasion, any amount of obfuscation, you can mislead as long as you have a semantic hook. As long as something may be technically true, they stamped. I mean, there was a lawyer who went and stamped page after page of all this research. I mean, attorney-client, and kept it. And it, in some ways, it's the way our legal system is set up. There is no duty not to mislead. In some ways, the lawyers really were co-conspirators in this fraud. There was one informant, the one I was talking about earlier, whose codename Veritas. Talking of the lawyers, he said they had more power than the kings. It's the legal system, the basis of how we've the core of legal ethics. This notion that no matter how much damage you inflict to the public, as long as you are doing this, I mean, in support of your client, and you are not committing a crime, you don't knowingly say anything false. If you add a word that obfuscates, if you hold back documents, that is part of our legal system. That's why I am convinced the last 50 years turned out the way they did. I mean,
How would you change that? I mean, we haven't even talked about how you'd change the distribution of, you know, the necessary maintenance nicotine for people who are hopelessly addicted. But how would you – we'll get to that. Plain brown wrappers, basically government production of this stuff. But how would you deal with these questions of – this habit of legal protection of the guilty?
It's a combat system. It's not a truth system. And certainly in a criminal context, you can understand maybe why, the client and the defense of the client becomes paramount to protect any individual against the power of the state. But certainly in a civil context, I mean, there really should be a duty not to mislead. I don't understand how the legal system, look, the fact is the whole basis of legal ethics gave these lawyers a way to live with themselves. It gave them a way to live with their conscience.
Rad had a question about foreign additives, the Turkish blend or whatever.
We got camels. We got a tip to check patents filed in foreign countries, and we found a patent, a Brazilian patent, for a tobacco that was codenamed Y1. It was genetically bred. Genetically engineered high nicotine tobacco. And we saw this patent. And then we had to literally, we went up and, I mean, this was, as you read this book, I mean, it really is a detective story. We went up and down the ports of call in the southeastern United States. Do you have any idea how many entries there are, I mean, every day into this country? And there, I mean, after days of going through these documents, on page 25 of one manifest from Sousa Cruz overseas through the Grand Cayman Islands to Brown and Williamson, it said in small print, your order, Project Y1. Why were they genetically breeding, genetically engineering high nicotine tobacco? Because they wanted to keep the nicotine levels up while tar levels came down. Otherwise, people would not smoke.
Rad, thank you. 1-800-423-8255 makes the nicotine connection. Carol is on the line.
Yeah, I agree that Congress never intended the FDA to regulate tobacco.
You agree with the Supreme Court, you mean?
Yeah, because the American people never intended such a thing. And what's really morally reprehensible is how the anti-smokers have lied about the health risks of smoking by purposely using defective studies to falsely blame smoking for diseases that are really caused by infections, all so that they can drum up hate against the tobacco companies.
Carol, stay on the line.
Can I ask a question? Does smoking cause cancer?
Which cancer?
Lung cancer.
You suppressed the research on adenoviruses, and you suppressed the research on adeno-associated viruses, and you suppressed other research on other viruses that cause cancer, also that you can blame smoking. And now in the real scientific world, there are studies showing that these viruses cause cancer. But then you look at these Surgeon General reports and the California EPA reports, and they hardly touch the subject of viruses, and that's because they're purposely using confounded studies.
There was a wonderful gentleman that allowed me to interview him for the book. He actually, as a child, he fled Nazi Germany. He went to work as, he was an organic chemist. He went to work as a munitions expert in Cuba, immigrated to the United States, and ended up in Winston-Salem in the 1950s, and really became R.J. Reynolds' chief scientist.
We're going to have to come back to that story, David Kessler. And Carol, we'll come back to you after a short break. We're talking about tobacco and our guest David Kessler's efforts at the FDA to regulate it. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Still ahead, the second hour of The Connection, when film and theater professors from Boston...
Dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com.
David Kessler is our guest, telling us about his efforts at the Food and Drug Administration to regulate tobacco as a drug. Carol is challenging his science. But David Kessler, you were also telling a story about a refugee from Nazi Germany by way of Cuba to this country. And what happened?
Ended up as R.J. Reynolds, one of R.J. Reynolds' chief scientists. Began working there in the 1950s. Probably knew more about smoking and health than anyone else, and certainly coordinated that company's strategy on how to deal with the whole issue of whether cigarettes cause cancer for 50 years. And when I meet him, when I'm writing the book, I met him last year, and he was in his 80s. And when he saw me, he said, "We are farther apart now than ever." And what he firmly believed that cigarettes, despite all the studies, the thousands and thousands, I mean, of studies, he firmly believed that cigarettes did not cause cancer. He said, "You know, people who smoke do bad things. They do other bad things, and it's those other bad things that cause cancer." And then he started talking, got very angry about, he really saw himself as a scientist, but he had a science of his own creation. And then he said something that I still remember him saying. He said, "It would be morally reprehensible to work for a tobacco company and believe that smoking caused cancer. It would be morally reprehensible." And he believed, I mean, Carol Carol, as I listen,
Kessler.
The caller, Carol, you don't believe that cigarettes cause cancer, right?
Mr. Kessler, there are 6,000 studies on smoking and lung cancer and scarcely a handful on adenovirus and lung cancer, and that's because you suppressed the research because you didn't want to know the answer, because I think you knew the answer, specifically Morris Green of St. Louis University, who was Robert J. Huebner's big contractor in the National Cancer Institute's virus cancer program, which was controlled by the American Cancer Society.
You know, what we did is we did not do any research. We didn't suppress any research. We went inside the tobacco industry to understand what their research showed, what they knew, and what they had learned from tobacco products. Look, what you see has happened. And I understand, you know, skepticism and cynicism, and I, you know, it's part of this country, and people are entitled to their opinions. But if you see what that script that was written back in the 50s and 60s, it said cigarettes are not proven to cause cancer. Every single tobacco executive got up and said that. Why'd they do that? So the reason they did that, what the lawyers wanted to do was to create a thin wedge of doubt. They wanted to be able to create just enough false doubt. I mean, there were these memos. They wanted to influence juries and judges. They wanted to give smokers a psychological crutch.
But what do you make of people like Carol who stick against not only the scientific evidence, but so many people's personal experience that heavy smokers wither and die. If it's not cancer, it's emphysema or heart failure or something else. And people will say, well, it's the stars or adenoviruses or they were just that way.
You know, people can believe what they want, and it's not my job to tell them what to believe, but the evidence is unequivocal. Smoking, it causes lung cancer. It causes other forms of cancer. If I see a man in his 40s in the emergency room presenting with a heart attack, the number one cause of that heart attack for a man in his 40s, I mean, is smoking. It is a deadly product.
Carol, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Michael is on the line.
Good morning, Dr. Kessler, and thank you very much for your efforts. My grandfather was a tobacco farmer in North Carolina for many years until his death about 25 years ago. So I know that neck of the woods pretty well. And so much of the discussion centers on the science and on the reprehensible behavior of the executives and the attorneys. But I sort of wonder how we deal with the people at the bottom, the people that farm, the people that work on the farms and that supply the farms. Yeah, these are good folks. They go to church. They support their neighbors. They have a healthy respect for one another, and they just can't see themselves as drug dealers.
I think it's a wonderful point. And look, I understand. I mean, in writing the book and in talking to people, I understand that for many people, the issue, tobacco is the difference between sending your kid to college and not sending your kid to college. It's about putting food on the table and not putting food on the table. But look, the writing has been on the wall, for decades. If you go back, and there's a part of me that rather than take all this money, I mean, that's ended up to these lawyers, I'd rather give this money to the farmers, I mean, and buy them out of growing tobacco. And I think that's what we should do. But there's also the point that, look, I mean, we've all had grandparents in different industries. Those industries have come and gone. And we have to recognize the fact is this is an addictive product. Look,
can I just ask Michael, it's something I wondered as I was reading David Kessler's book.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure these are superb farmers, but I always wonder why can't they grow strawberries or lettuce, or all sorts of other delightful things to ingest. It's not as if they had to grow tobacco. I also wonder, I must say, in a world where these guys, you know, are saddled with $145 billion punitive damage burden in the Florida case, or and more on the way. How in the world does this stay a profitable industry to work in? And I simply wonder if, you know, if they discovered it caused a nuclear war, they'd think of something else to grow. Why don't they do other things?
Well, you know, that's it's a good question, but I think the answer is a little harder than that. One of the bad things that the tobacco industry has done over all the years is has kept the economy from diversifying in these areas. So the only work that you can get is, you know, working in a tobacco barn or something like that. So it's been, you know, there's been a dependency created that a lot of the farmers may not be fully aware of. But it's sort of one thing to say, well, just grow corn or grow strawberries or something like that. But those markets are also pretty unstable. And, you know, if you're trying to send your kids to college, it's sort of what's the sure thing versus the risky thing. I want to be clear on one thing. You know, I'm not defending it. I think Dante's Hell was far too pleasant for tobacco lobbyists. But at the same time, you're talking about, you know, hundreds of thousands of acres. And to try to take them out of one crop and to put them into another is, you know, that's a difficult thing to do. But I think the first thing you want to establish is how can you convince these folks that you're not their enemies and that you're not picking on them and try to get them to...
It's a fair question.
And in some ways, I didn't fully understand. I mean, there is, I mean, I think the caller's point... I think these people really thought that we were calling them drug dealers, and they were offended by that. And I understand. I think, in talking to them, I mean, have come to understand. I mean, how they see it, and felt that this was just the government coming after them. Look, the fact is, if you go to work every day at Philip Morris, there is something that you believe in that's more important than public health. If you go to work every day at Philip Morris, I mean, it's not money. I mean, what I think the industry, in talking to people, I mean, who work there, this is an issue about something more important than health. This is an issue about freedom. This is an issue about choice. I mean, and that's what's at stake. And that's the argument they have used in front of the American public for decades. What I didn't understand, I mean, until I started seeing and researching the book, one of the general counsels gets up at a Philip Morris board meeting early on during our investigation. Obviously, I didn't know about this until I was writing the book. And he said, this is ominous. This is the FDA's investigation is very dangerous. He knew before I knew that we were aimed at the heart of the industry. Because once you start look at the question of whether nicotine is addictive, and you recognize that no one picks up a cigarette and says, I'm going to smoke this one and 400,000 more. But more importantly, and I didn't understand this even as a pediatrician, is that that addiction takes place in childhood, in adolescence. You don't start smoking when you're 19, 20, or 21. That 11, 12, and 13-year-old, I always had that image of that 11, 12, and 13-year-old going off experimenting with their first cigarette. But what I didn't understand was that 11, 12, and 13-year-old becomes addicted at 16, 17, or 18. Until I realized that nicotine addiction begins as a pediatric disease. Once I understood that, I mean, that's why the industry understood why our investigation was so dangerous. They today, if you own a tobacco company, you own a liability. We didn't win in the Supreme Court. We couldn't get the Congress to side with us. But that last chapter of the book, I'm sitting there with the senior executive from Philip Morris, and I'm sitting there in a coffee shop, and I said to him, what did we get right? And he said, what I think you got right was the fact when you have a product that harms people, that kills people, that is addictive. This is a senior executive at Philip Morris, Steve Parrish, saying when you have a product that harms people, kills people, and is addictive, I think it has to be regulated. That was exactly what we were saying in the early 1990s.
That's the last chapter. I should have said earlier that the first chapter of David Kessler's book, the book is called A Question of Intent. The first chapter of the book is available on our website at theconnection.org. Matthew is on the line.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, Matthew.
My question is basically, what current things is David doing to fight the tobacco company? Not that there's a lot that he can do.
Out of office, you mean?
Yes. And about, that last caller, I think she was nuts. The evidence is obvious that smoking is bad for your health. So I just, that's just my first question, basically.
So, what are you doing, Dr. Kessler, for your next act?
I'm at that wonderful institution that doesn't get mentioned a lot in Boston, that wonderful university in New Haven.
You've heard of that.
I'm dean of the medical school at Yale. My job, the reason I wrote this, is to train the next generation of young people to take on issues, whatever the issues are. It doesn't have to be tobacco. That's why I wrote the book, and that's why I'm dean of the medical school.
You're training the doctors. You're also training the citizens in a fashion. What is the message to citizens about, or even to young people working with the Bush administration in Washington? I love that line, you know, if your mission is to keep your job for the government, you won't be able to do your job for the government. But what do citizens have to do?
You know, you get these jobs. You come to Washington, you get these jobs. You've wanted these jobs all your life. It's not the job that's important. It's what are you going to accomplish in those jobs? What do you really want to do? I mean, I think more than anything, that is, you know, we're put on this earth, and the question is, I mean, are we going to be willing to take on challenges? The reason this was big tobacco is that we allowed it to be big tobacco.
David Kessler, thank you. It's a wonderful hour, and it's a wonderful book called A Question of Intent, A Great American Battle with a Deadly Industry, his own memoir of fighting the tobacco industry at the Food and Drug Administration. You can continue the tobacco regulation conversation, Connection listeners, on our website at theconnection.org, and you can get a good sampling of the book in the first chapter, which is on our website, theconnection.org. Thank you, David Kessler. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and by the Allaire Corporation.